Hello there, and welcome to another study in our current series of Bible-based Broken Bread Bible studies, brought to a computer or mobile phone near to you week by week, with me, Ron Bailey from BibleBased.com, and Mike Coles from NewLifeRadio.co.uk, from where, if you've missed any of these studies, you can visit Mike's website and find a section called Previous Broadcasts and New Life Radio Audio Library. There's a catchy title for you. Look for my name, Ron Bailey. The section is CG-The Better Covenant, A Study Guide. And you'll find there the list of the previous 37 studies that we've done in this series. And you can return to them anytime you like. So this is study 38 of our current series, based on the book The Better Covenant. And I've called the series The Better Covenant Revisited. We are using the book as a kind of a baseline and adding other related insights and links as they come to mind. And you can find these studies in all kinds of places. You can find them in our Bible-based podcasts. And if you've not tried podcasts, I recommend you give it a try. Or at BibleBased.com. Or in our Facebook group, known as Friends of BibleBase. And as I've said, at newliferadio.co.uk with Mike Coles. If you'd like more details and notes, you'll find my broadcast notes, the ones that I work from, for the study I'm recording right now at BibleBase.com. And if you've just joined us on this journey, may I suggest that you go back at least to study 37, as we're in the midst of a theme within a theme, and hopefully this will be much easier to understand if you've already listened to study 37, as in Adam. So, this is study 38 that I have entitled, There Is No Hope. Now, there's a cheerful title. But as my old pastor used to say to me, you can't really preach the good news until you've preached the bad news. So let's make a start. And what I'm going to do, in the main, I'm going to concentrate on a single watershed verse. There are some mountain ranges and you may get two drops of water coming down in the rain and one will fall half an inch away from the other. One will go east and one will go west. And they call that a watershed, where there's a definite dividing. And this verse is an amazing revelation as it moves now from a concentration on justification by faith and moves into different territory. And I would say almost unique territory. This is such a valuable part of the scripture. Let me read it to you first. This is Romans chapter 5, beginning in the middle of the chapter, chapter 12, and I'm just going to read actually two verses. Therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men, because all sinned. Because of this is Young's translation now, because of this, even as through one man the sin did enter into the world, and through the sin the death, thus to all men the death did pass through, for that all did sin. Now, if you're listening to that, you think, well, that's a peculiar way of translating things. Why does this translation keep on using the word did? Well, he's trying to bring out something that older grammarians, Bible translators, used to believe very firmly. People are kind of wondering about it now. I'm still with the old school. And what he's really saying is that the aorist tense, although it can be seen as a kind of a tense almost without a tense, it's a non-defined text, the general understanding and the general use of the Greek aorist tense is just in a simple past tense. Just, it's looking at a moment, an event. That moment may be part of a process, but it's looking at that one thing. So he's trying to capture this when he says, even as through one man the sin did enter. There's a point here, into the world. And through the sin, the death. And thus to all the men, sin did pass through, for all did sin. He has in mind here an event. a crisis event, an event which was, in many senses, the watershed. It changed the world that Adam knew in the delights and the perfections of Eden into the world that we know. And if you're using the notes, I've put various translations of that verse for you so that you can look at them. Let me give you an illustration, if I can. This is, remember, just an illustration. It's in all illustrations. If you push them too far, they bend and break and are more trouble than they're worth. But for my first few 6 or 7 years after leaving a school, I worked in a bank. I was a bank clerk and a bank cashier. And for quite a period of that time, I was in charge of what they called a sub-branch. In fact, two separate sub-branches at different times. These were usually almost like front rooms of houses occasionally. Sometimes they were actually in old shops, or very, very occasionally, they might even have been built as a bank. And the only staff at a sub-branch was the cashier and a guard. And my guards were usually... it's interesting how I say this now. My guards were usually old men in their 70s, says he who's now approaching his 80s. But I was in charge of this sub-branch, and people would come in wanting to open accounts, and I would have to explain to them, don't panic at this, I had to explain to them what was joint and several liability. If they wanted to open an account that was a joint account, a husband and wife, I had to get them to fill in the card, and then in those days we used to have a sixpenny stamp, and they had to, both of them, sign their names through that stamp. And it created what's known as a joint and several liability. What it really means is you're making it very clear to the person that the husband will now be liable for his wife's debts on that account. And you're making clear to the wife that she will be liable for her husband's debts on that account. In other words, it creates something. You're telling them, the individuals, the husband and the wife, that really your house is at risk. If your husband gambles and you end up with a new enormous gambling debt, I wouldn't have used this illustration, by the way, but if you gambled your house away, then it was your husband's house that had gone as well. So what it really means is that in the eyes of banking law, these two people have become one. They are inseparable as regards their actions or as regards their liabilities. They have become, in a sense, one flesh, one person, as the bank understands them. The husband and the wife have become a single corporate entity. As the law sees them, they are one person. And in Victorian times, this produced some very interesting things. I don't know whether you read Charles Dickens' old Victorian novels at all, or whether you've seen the musical called Oliver. But there is a character in there who is the local sort of poor law enforcer, a man named Mr. Bumble, who is the beadle. And he is a pompous character with a great kind of roaring stentorian voice. And he lays down the law and makes sure it gets enacted. And his wife is an absolute tartar of a woman, and he's absolutely under her thumb. And she does certain things which have their repercussions. And I'm going to try to explain that now with this quotation from Charles Dickens. This is a man who's speaking and really berating Mr. Bumble for what Mr. Bumble has done. It was all Mrs. Bumble. She would do it, urged Mr. Bumble, first looking around to ascertain that his partner had left the room. That's no excuse, replied Mr. Brownlow. You are present on the occasion of the destruction of these trinkets, and indeed all the more guilty of the two in the eyes of the law, for the law supposes that your wife acts under your direction. If the law supposes that, said Mr. Bumble, squeezing his hat emphatically in both hands, the law is an ass, an idiot. And if that's the eye of the law is a bachelor. And the worst I wish the law is that his eye may be opened by experience, sir, by experience. I don't know whether you've followed all that, but he's protesting at this notion that he is responsible for his wife's action. But it is a legal necessity when you open a joint account like this. There are other kinds of joint and several liabilities. You might have somebody that you go into business with and you form a business partnership. And again, you have to explain that what's happening now with this business partnership is that the debts of the business become liable in the history, in the life of each of the individuals. Again, you're telling them your house is at risk. In the eyes of the law, you've become one flesh, one person. Both individuals have become a single corporate entity. So why this complicated illustration? Well, because if we look at Adam, he was an individual and he was individually responsible for his own action. But he was not only an individual, he was the corporate head of the human race. And his wife was part of him in this sense. Let me give you a biblical illustration, which may help, and it may confuse. It's in the letter to the Hebrews, where the writer declares that Levi, do you remember Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then Jacob had 12 sons, and one of those was named Levi, and it was from Levi that the priesthood arose. So there's a statement here that Levi was in Abraham. In other words, he was in his great-grandfather. Is that right? Yes. Okay, this is Hebrews chapter 7, verses 5 and 10. Maybe you've looked at this verse and thought this is a peculiar way of looking at things. And indeed, those who are of the sons of Levi, who receive the priesthood, have a commandment to receive tithes from the people according to the law, that is, from their brethren, though they have come from the loins of Abraham. But he whose genealogy is not derived from them, he's thinking of Christ here, but he whose genealogy is not derived from them, received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. Now, beyond all contradiction, the lesser is blessed by the better. Here, mortal men receive tithes, and there he receives them, of whom it is witnessed that he lives. It's referring to Christ. But then he illustrates it, and it says, even Levi, remember Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Levi, even Levi, who receives tithes from his other brothers, the people of Israel, the children of Israel, even Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes through Adam, so to speak, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Now, if you don't know that story about Abraham meeting Melchizedek, that won't make much sense to you at all. But he's making a statement here that there was, so to speak, he uses this phrase, little phrase, there was a sense in which Levi, Abraham's grandson, who from whom the priesthood came and to whom the others gave tithes, he actually was in the loins of his grandfather when Abraham paid a tithe to Melchizedek. And so he's making a point here that the kind of priesthood that Melchizedek had, a king priest, is greater than, better than, it's one of the great themes of Hebrews, is greater than, better than the Levitical priesthood. The point I want to make is that God looks at things in certain ways that maybe are not natural or immediately obvious to us. At one and the same time, he can look at an individual and a nation and a people who may stretch beyond one national boundary and the whole world. And he doesn't have to decide which one he's talking or thinking about because he has all these roles, all these experiences, all these identities in his view at the same time. So in the way that the banker would explain to the husband and the wife that in the eyes of the bank they are one person, the man who's conducting this opening of the account knows that actually there are two individuals here in front of them. But in the eyes of the law, in the eyes of what's going to happen, they've now become one corporate entity. And there is a sense in which there is, well, I think this is one of the reasons why any racialism, any racist notions are just absolutely nonsense, because, and it's impossible for any Christian to really take part in them, simply because the scripture plainly says, when Paul spoke to the people at Athens, he said that from one blood, God had brought all the families of the earth. So there is one race. Biblically, there is no such thing as races. There's just one race, the human race. And the federal head of that human race is Adam. We all come from Adam. This is the revelation. Now, of course, Adam wasn't alone for very long, so far as we know, because Eve was made for him out of a rib. It is very interesting that God created Adam, bara, which is the Hebrew word, which is only used of God, and is very often has the indication that he made it from nothing. So God created Adam, but God made Eve. He uses different words. He uses the word of being a potter for Adam and the word of being a builder for Eve. So although the man and the wife are one, in fact, they are two individuals and they have their own individual liabilities in one sense. Let me move on a little bit and you'll see what I'm trying to say. I wonder, this is my second section. I'm calling this Adam, pause, and Eve. Adam and Eve. This is Genesis chapter 2, verses 15 and 17. And Jehovah God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. And Jehovah God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that you eatest thereof thou shalt surely die. Now, I've gone back to the American Standard Version of this because I wanted this personal pronoun, thee and thou. We've lost it in modern English. But it's in Hebrew and it's in Greek, and sometimes it is very, very significant. This is thee and thou. So when it says God commanded the man, he's referring to Adam here. Of course, Eve wasn't made at this point either. And then when she is made, the man, Adam, says this. I think this is a wonderful picture here. And the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Now, what does that mean? Because if we follow this story literally, Eve was made from a bone of Adam. But here Adam says, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. So where did the flesh come from? You say, oh, help, where are we going with this? This little phrase, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, this idea of bones and flesh is a term that's used really quite regularly in different parts of the Bible. And what it really means is family. There's a place, for example, in 1 Chronicles 11 and verse 1, where the two potential different nations of Judah and Israel, although they weren't at that stage, they come together and they decide unitedly that they want David to be their anointed king. And they come to David with this plea, and this is what they say. All Israel came together to David at Hebron, saying, indeed, we are your bone and your flesh. In other words, they're saying to David, we are your family. We are one. There's a lovely old chorus. We are heirs of the Father. We are joint heirs with the Son. We are children of the kingdom. We are family. We are one. And this phrase, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, really means, well, it means family. So if you haven't forgotten or tried to forget my previous illustration, this is the effect of creating what you might say, what did I call it? A corporate entity, a unit which has its own boundaries, its own blessings, its own relationships. And he says, Adam, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of men. Therefore shall a man leave his mother, his father, and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Now, you quite often hear people say, this is what God said. If you read it carefully, you'll find this is what Adam said. So where this man has just woken up from his sleep, and he's seen, no doubt, this beautiful woman in front of him, and he says, this is now bone of my, this is what I was looking for. This is what I couldn't find in the rest of the animal creation. Here she is. And we belong to one another. She answers to me in the sense that she is perfectly compatible with me. It's bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. And she shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Now, I think we need to interpret one flesh in the sense that this it's already been introduced to us in these verses. This is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. What Adam is saying is that we are one. And in the future, what will happen is that a man will leave his father and his mother, leave and cleave. That's the essence of marriage. Leave his father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. They'll be one. Now, where did he get that idea from? Where did that come from? Well, remember, we're in Genesis chapter 2, and sin doesn't come into the world until Genesis chapter 3. This is a revelation. These are the words of Adam. But at this moment in the world's history, Adam was innocent, and his clear spirit was open to divine revelation. I have no doubt this was God given. This was a man being taught how to live the life that God wanted him to live. And this is a fundamental part of it. He recognizes that as a result of a union here, they will become one flesh. Leave and cleave. The word cleave has to do with sticking things together with glue. So this is a real kind of strong strong bond. It's a revelation. Now, here's another revelation, and this also comes from a man of God. This comes from Paul. And when I read this revelation to you, I think some hairs are going to stick up on the back of some people's necks, and they will think, where is he going? I'm not going anywhere. I just want to, at this point, I just want to read you this verse. This is 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 7 to 9. Just remember that phrase that came in the beginning where God said he would come and he would, this is what God would do. So let's listen, 1 Corinthians 11, 7 to 9. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head. Whoa. I'm not going to talk about women at all here at this point. I actually shared on this topic some years ago in a fellowship in Canada at a men's meeting, breakfast in the morning. And I shared on the topic of why a man ought not to cover his head when the saints gather together. I see if I can trace you a copy if you're interested. But I just want to take this point, really. Don't get distracted. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. Now you say, oh, but she's an individual. Of course she's an individual. But in another relationship, the woman, the wife, is the glory of the man. For the man is not from the woman, but the woman from the man. Nor was man created for the woman, but woman for the man. We're looking at a particular aspect of the role of what it means to be human beings. And there are many roles that we have as human beings. But there is one here that is significant, and he goes straight back to Genesis before sin entered the world, when there was no tension, there was no pressure of one above another, when there was nothing of subservience or being under one another's heel, but just simply this, that there was a difference between the man and the woman, and in a particular context, they're one. And in another context, in their individuality, they express some important truths, which I'm not going to talk about in this study. I'm not teasing you. I just don't want us to get distracted. So I said I was going to kind of base this on a single verse, and the single verse I drew your attention to was the one where it says, Romans chapter 5 and verse 12, therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men, because all sinned. What is this verse all about? Well, I've introduced it in study 37, I hope, a little bit, so I'm just going to start from where we are now. So, if this is true, and we believe it is revelation, through one man sin entered into the world. Now, this is an interesting thing for me, because in many contexts, and I think I mentioned this the last time we were together, in many contexts, the woman is blamed for this, for introducing sin into the world. But Paul is absolutely crystal clear. It was not the woman who introduced sin into the world. It was the men. And you say, but didn't she take the fruit first? Yes, she did. But she was not the federal head of the human race. As an individual, she sinned. Adam sinned as an individual. He also sinned as the representative of the entire human race. And that had implications. Okay, let's look at this. I want to think about what is often called original sin. That's not one of my favorite titles for it, because, as we'll see in a moment, sin did not originate with Adam. As some people call it, hereditary sin. I'm not very happy with that one either, because hereditary seems to indicate that it passes down from father to son to grandson, from etc., from mother all the way down, that it goes down through the generations, and each generation inherits it, hence hereditary sin, from the previous generation. I'm not happy with that one either. Notice that Eve's transgression did not change Adam, but Adam's did change Eve, and it changed you, and it changed me. Adam was not of Eve, but Eve was of Adam. Let's go back to Genesis and see the follow-through of this. This is Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. And Jehovah God called unto the man and said to him, where art thou? There's that thou again. Jehovah God called unto the man and said unto him, where art thou? When God comes in the language of the way that all this is expressed in Genesis, when God comes into the Garden of Eden, walking in the cool of the day, he comes looking for the man. And he comes looking for the man because God, of course, really knows all things. So he doesn't need information from anybody, but he needs to give people an opportunity to acknowledge what they have done at certain times. So he comes here and he says to the man, where art thou? Thou. In other words, he comes to the man for the man's report of what has taken place. He holds the man accountable for what is taking place. Where art thou? Chapter 3 and verse 17 says this, you know how that story works out, don't you? Adam says it was the woman says it was the serpent, and then God begins to speak. And first of all, well, I'll just read from Genesis 3 and verse 17. "And unto Adam he said, because thou," listen to all the thous in these two, said, let me count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. In these three verses, the word thou is used three times, and it's Adam that God is speaking to. So listen what God has to say to Adam. "Adam, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake." Now let me say something again. There is an idea abroad, and it's been there for a long, long time, that God cursed Adam, and that he cursed woman, and that he cursed woman with increased fertility and pain and anxiety in her childbirth, and put the man over the woman. Where does that say that's a curse? When God speaks to the woman, he never mentions the word curse. This is simply God speaking a consequence of what will happen as a result of what her action has been. "Unto Adam," he said, "because thou hast hearkened to the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake." You know, the only thing that's cursed in this passage is the ground. Oh yes, I know that there's that curse on Satan as well. But I mean, in this sense, it's the ground that is cursed. And God says, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for thy sake. Not for you, plural sake. Not because of what you and Eve have done. The ground is cursed because what you have done. In toil, thou shalt eat of it. All the days of thy life, thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. And thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it thou wast taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. It's interesting, of course, that Eve never was dust, was she? Man was taken of the earth, of the dust, but not the woman. This is an address of God speaking to the man as the federal head of the human race, and making it quite clear that God holds him accountable for what has done, what has happened, and for the consequences of it. Eve is not cursed. Adam is not cursed. It's only the ground that is cursed, but the ground is cursed for Adam's sake. Adam was an individual, but he was also the federal head of our race. His personal sin could be forgiven. But in his capacity of the federal head, our race, his action was irreversible, and its consequences are incalculable. Adam's sin, as the federal head of our race, opened the door to sin. In my notes, I've got sin the second time round in uppercase, capital letters. Adam's sin, small case, lower letters. Adam's sin as the federal head of our race opened the door to sin. From now on, I'll just say with a capital S. Not as an item on his personal account as a sinner, but as a ruling power. And from Romans chapter 5 and verse 12, in the next little section of Romans, we are facing not the individual transgression of a sin, not the marking of Adam's or Eve's scorecard. We're dealing with, this is Paul's revelation, we're dealing with something that happened. Adam's sin as the federal head of our race opened the door to sin, not as an item on his personal account as a sinner, but as a ruling power. And we will need to distinguish between sin as an event and sin as a ruling power. Now, the Bible truth of justification by faith provides a remedy for sin as an event, or sins as a collection of events or sins. But we need more. Much more. That's where we were last week, isn't it? Much more. We need something that will not only make a provision for our guilt in our transgression, but something that will deal with the ruling power that entered our race through Adam. This is Romans 5 verse 12. Because of this, this is Young's literal translation, even as through one man. Now, I'm going to go through this phrase by phrase. Through one man. Now, Eve transgressed. It says that quite plainly in the scriptures. Adam transgressed, but Adam did something else. Adam opened the door to sin. He said yes to an event which really introduced an alien spirit into what it means to be a human being. Through one man, sin did enter into the world. And through sin, death. Now, what kind of death is he talking about here? Well, we know, don't we, that Adam lived almost 1,000 years after this event, as far as we can tell. So God had said, if you remember, in the day that you eat of it, you shall die. In other words, the punishment for the sin, the act of the judge bringing his verdict and his judgment, took place instantly in the day that Adam, ate of it. He was the one who'd been given the instruction. In the day that thou eatest of it, in the day, Adam, that you take this thing, you will die. Dying, you will die, the Hebrew says. That's really a very emphatic way of something. This is the ultimate death. This is death in its deepest possible dimension. The Hebrews did that. If they wanted to emphasize something or to make it the ultimate, they would double it up. So we have phrases like the Holy of Holies, which means the ultimately holy place. Or we have the King of Kings, who was the ultimate King of Kings, or and so on. Or the Song of Songs, which is the best of all the songs of Solomon. So it means the ultimate. So what happened was that he was going to die. Dying, he would die. Now, that isn't physical death. It will involve physical death. The consequence of it will be physical death. But if you read this story carefully, you'll discover that physical death came about as a result of the fact that man was now separated from the tree of life. You read the story carefully and think about it. Now, as I was saying, the Bible truth of justification by faith provides a remedy for sin as an event, or sins as a collection of sins. But we need more, much more. We need something that will deal with the ruling power that entered our race through Adam. Because of this, even as through one man, sin entered the world. Imagine this. Where are you sitting now? I presume almost certainly you'll be sitting in a room of some kind. And I presume that you came into that room through a door. You entered the room where you were sitting by that door. Look at it. You entered by a door. Now, you did not begin to exist when you entered through that door. You had a prior existence to that door. And you came into the room from another place. Now, sin entered the world. Sin did not begin with Adam. Adam is not the origin of sin. And this is why this passage is really so important. Adam is not the origin of sin. Satan is the origin of sin. And Satan came into our world through the door that Adam opened by his own rebellious act against the will of God. Because of this, even as through one man the sin did enter. That language about entering like that, the word that's used is sometimes used of maybe if you can imagine a stage, and it's got different characters on the stage. It's got a rich man, a poor man. I'm just making this up as I go along. But the rich man comes onto the stage, and we might say he makes his entrance. Now, he didn't just suddenly become a human being the moment he appears on the stage. He makes an entrance. And it's this kind of sense here. Through one man, sin makes an entrance into the world. Now, that's the word really which in the Greek would have to do with the cosmos. In fact, it is the word cosmos. And that's one of these words that has a broad width of meaning. We need to look at it in its context, really, to understand what it's saying. But it has to do with physicality. It has to do with things, the order of things, the pattern of things. Because of this, even as through one man, Adam is the door, sin made its entrance into the cosmos. And now we've got sin in that perfect creation. Sin with a capital S. Sin as a ruling power. That God said was good. And then finally, with Adam and Eve, very good. Now, sin has made its entrance. And it goes on to say, and through sin, death. They came in as a matched pair, these two. As sin came in, death came in. And then, this is Paul, of course, writing by revelation, thus to all men, as all human beings, through all human beings, death passed through. So what is this? This isn't contagious. This is, I don't know what the right medical word is. It's not just in the population, it's in the individual. Sin passed through immediately to the whole of Adam's progeny. Right the way down to the last baby that will be born before the Lord returns. It's already there. In the same way as you've got that sense of Levi paying tithes through Abraham to Melchizedek, even though he was still in the loins of Abraham, in some sense, there's a revelation here that death passed to all men. Not sequentially, not from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to Levi, etc., but somehow the whole thing, it's in the nature of what it now means to be a human being, that we start off our life under a ruling power that entered our race once at a specific time through Adam, and thus to all men death passed through, for that all did sin. What it's telling us here is that in some sense, all of us were in Adam when Adam sinned. In the same way that Levi was in Abraham when Abraham offered his tithe, so the whole world was in Adam when Adam opened the door and sin entered. So it came in through one man. I don't think of it coming down through the generations. You know, there are some people who try to understand this, and they attach the truth of the virgin birth to it, and they say, oh, well, it must come down through the male line. That's sheer speculation. We're dabbling in things of which we have no understanding. As a verse in the Proverbs that says, even a foolish man will be thought wise if he keeps his mouth shut. That's my version of it. It's better to leave some things unsaid. I have no idea how this happened. except that I have this revelation, which says it did happen. In the moment that Adam opened the door to sin with a capital S, it was the whole race, down through all its generations, that was infected. And here's an interesting thing. Somehow it passed sideways. You see, Eve's sin doesn't seem to have impacted Adam, but Adam's sin impacted Eve. As a result of Adam's sin, Eve became infected with the sin, with a capital S. It passed sideways, not just downwards. So, not downwards through the generations, in my view, but the entire race was infected through one man, and at one point in time, through one man, sin entered into the world. And death through sin. How can I explain this? This spread to all men in whom Adam is the one in whom. Let me put that in there. Death spread to all people when Adam sinned. All sinned in Adam, and death spread to all people. I've put some notes, more detailed notes, in the study if you want to kind of trace that through. We must press on. Here's a trace on the route through one man sin entered and death entered through sin, and thus, as a consequence of that, death came too. This is not a separate event of death arriving second through sin. It's not subsequent, that to say, the next step. It's just simply, it's the consequence. He only comes, said Jesus, referring to the thief, to slay and to kill and to destroy. And he brought that alien spirit into our race. Let me say something. The time is going, but let me say this. On two occasions, I've been to Auschwitz. I've been to Majdanek. I somehow felt in my heart that when I was preaching in Poland, I made many visits to Poland over the years, I ought to go as a human being and be a witness to this atrocity. You see, occasionally people will look at the behavior of men and women and they say, they're not human, they're like animals. But I've been to Auschwitz, and animals don't behave like humans. There is something malicious that's possible in the hearts of men and women, which is, I'm tempted to call it demonic, but I don't want to call it that because you might think you can cast it out. So I'm going to call it diabolic. There's an essence, there's something in human beings which makes them capable of the most, almost unimaginable acts of violence against one another. And not just to provide a food for the next meal in the way that an animal might do it, but for the sheer pleasure of seeing someone suffer, enjoying, killing and slaying and destroying. What is this? Well, let me tell you, this was not in man when God said he is very good, when he was combined with Eve. It wasn't there. This is something that's coming, and this is the only explanation to our world, to its beauty and its tragedy, to its glory and its horror. At one moment, you can look at some aspect of the creation and say it's wonderful. You can see God's wonderful order in it. And at another moment, you say, just look at this. This is chaos. Absolute chaos. We're living in a world that is not as it was created. We're living in a world which has been infected by a sin that came into the cosmos, into our world, through Adam. So this is not an event separate from death entering through sin. It's not a subsequence, it's just a consequence. So the entrance of sin and death into our world, cosmos, is this kind of harmonious arrangement of order, and then it came to denote the world or the universe. And there's this idea of something entering. These are powerful, powerful pictures. Let me read it again. How many words are there here in English? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 31. 31 words, which is the only explanation I know to the world as we have found it, and to the world as we have lived in it. Theologians have called this original sin or hereditary sin or other things, but that's moving on to what they call transmission. How does it go from one to the other? And I've already told you what my view is of that thing. So I want to say something about this sin that made an entrance through Adam and which instantly infected the whole of Adam's progeny while they were still in his loins. I'm not talking genetics here. I'm talking things of the spirit. This condition is incurable, and the Bible does not bring this essential Bible truth into focus until God already has a remedy available for it. You don't see this expressed in the way that Paul expresses it in the Old Covenant Scriptures. You see the consequence of it. You see aspects of it in all kinds of places, but there's nothing that you could really get a grip of until you come to this statement of Paul's, and then you see why some of these things were written. Let me take this one, for example. In Jeremiah chapter 17 and verse 1, God is bringing an accusation really about idolatry against the people of Judah. And that's the main sin at this point. And this is Jeremiah 17 verse 1. The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron and with the point of a diamond. It is graven upon the tablet of their heart and upon the horns of their altars. Now, this is very poetic language, of course. But when it says the sin of Judah is written with the pen of iron, he's really talking about a chisel and with the point of a diamond. In other words, it is graven. There's the word. It is graven. It isn't painted on there. It isn't like a splash of mud that you can wash off in a shower. It's immovable. It's incurable. It's not possible to deal with this in any way. It's just there. People discover inscriptions carved into stone that go back who knows how many thousands of years. In Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 1, it begins by saying the sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron and with the point of a diamond. It's graven upon the tablet of their heart. Notice now, you've got the picture here of a heart which is stone in some way, and its sin is engraved into it. This isn't superficial. This isn't something that can be peeled off. A few verses later on in Jeremiah 17 and verse 9, you have these verses that maybe you learned when you were very much younger. Jeremiah 17 verses 9 to 10. The heart is deceitful above all things. This is the American Standard Version. And it is exceedingly corrupt. Who can know it? Jehovah searches the mind. I try the heart, even to give to every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. Now, this word that's translated exceedingly corrupt is a word that really is linked to things which are incurable. So there are translations of this, and this is one here I've got in front of me. This is Young's literal translation. Crooked is the heart, twisted, deceitful, bent, crooked is the heart above all things, and it is incurable. That's why I've titled this particular study, There Is No Hope. At this point, God just simply says it's incurable. Who knows it? Or as the NET Bible says, the human heart is more deceitful than anything else. It is incurably bad. Who can understand it? So there is something about the way that men and women behave which is beyond understanding. There is a wickedness that we are capable of which just is beyond the boundaries of our imagination. And people have used their imaginations to create hideous forms of hurt and pain for other human beings. But there's a spirit, there's an alien spirit, which has ruined our race. Is another little phrase. This is in Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 7. And it says this, as a fountain wells up with water, so she, this is the city he's talking about, she wells up with her wickedness. Violence and plundering are heard in her. Before me continually are grief and wounds. Maybe that isn't such a well-known verse, but just listen to it. As a fountain wells up water, constantly bubbling up. This isn't a reserve. This is a source of something that is bubbling up inside. There's something which is present all the time, bubbles up, and frequently overflows. How about this one? This is Isaiah chapter 57, verses 20 and 21. But the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There is no peace, says my God, for the wicked. What vivid pictures these are, these pictures in Jeremiah and in Isaiah that use water, the bubbling up of a fountain, but it's not coming up with clear, crystal clear water, it's coming up with wickedness, violence, plundering a herd in her. Or in Isaiah, the wicked are like the troubled seas when it cannot rest. You imagine this picture, if you've kind of been to the coast, maybe when there's been some heavy seas or strong winds or something like that, you'll find all kinds of debris on the beach. Maybe in some context, dead bodies that the sea has just unearthed up and pushed out. All hidden, hardly any sign of it. Nobody knew anything about it. Beautiful picture it was yesterday. Look at it today. With all this death and deadness spread around. And Isaiah says, the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There's no end to the possibilities of human wickedness. You say, well, this is really desperate news. If this is the final diagnosis, what hope is there for those who are in Adam? Oh, well, there's the clue. If this is the final diagnosis for those who are in Adam, now what shall we say? And if you think I'm exaggerating when I say what wickedness human beings are capable of, there was a time when God took away his restraining hand and sin was unbridled and it cried, crucify him. There's an alien spirit in Adam, and at bottom it wants nothing to do with God. And if need be, it'll put him to death to avoid his interference. As Jesus said, the thief does not come to steal, except to steal and to kill and to destroy. That's the cosmic vandal. And by our first birth, when we're in Adam, other than the mercy of God's restraining hand, there is no wickedness of which we are not capable. Whatever you think was the worst human being that ever lived, he was a human being like you and me. There, but for the grace of God, go you and me. There's no hope. There is no hope in Adam. It's incurable. tell our children to give their heart to Jesus. Jeremiah says it's incurable. There's no hope in Adam. God will have to start again with a new man and take us out of Adam and put us into the new man. And we'll look at that, God willing, next time we're together. Thank you for listening. Do come join us again. God bless you.